This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross.
Before states ran legal lotteries, there was the underground street version, the numbers. Some numbers games were run by organized crime. Some were run by enterprising individuals whose best chance at prosperity was through the underground economy. In 1960s Detroit, at a time when a lot of African Americans were shut out of job and economic opportunities, Fannie Davis started running her own numbers operation. She did well and raised her 5 children in a comfortable home that she owned. One of those children is my guest, Bridgette Davis. She's written a new memoir about her mother called The World According to Fannie Davis, My Mother's Life in the Detroit Numbers. Her mother's profits from being a numbers runner enabled Bridgette to attend Spelman College. She went on to graduate from the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. She's the author of 2 novels and is a creative writing professor at Baruch College of the City University of New York, where she directs the Writer in Residence program. Bridgette Davis, welcome to Fresh Air. I want to start by asking you to describe the numbers at the time your mother started working as a numbers runner.
The numbers were, first of all, illegal. They were a precursor to the legal lottery that we all know about today. So when my mom launched her business in 1958, she was stepping into an already thriving and robust business. It just happened to be underground. Black folks knew about it, and they called it the numbers. It basically existed across the country thanks to the Great Migration. Black folks had taken this business to different cities, even though it began in Harlem. So by the time my mom stepped into it in Detroit, she was able to have a ready set of customers because people were already playing the numbers. She simply went to her neighbors and friends and said, "I'm now going to be banking the numbers." That was how she expressed it. "You can give your bets to me."
Explain how that worked in the underground economy.
It really was just a matter of making sure the authorities didn't find out, but really circulating those dollars in the community over and over again. So you might go to someone's home and you would give that person the numbers you wanted to play for that day, and you would pay for those numbers in cash. The person would take the money like any good bookie. And then that evening when the number came out, let's say you were lucky and you won, you would go back to that bookie and collect your winnings. And if you didn't win, the bookie kept your money. And so imagine that across dozens and dozens of people doing this throughout just one city, and you can see that it was an actual economy. People were employed by the big numbers men, as they called themselves. They had various jobs that they performed, and then you had all of your different levels of customers, small bettors and big bettors.
And how are the winning numbers decided?
Well, originally, supposedly, this is the legend, one man came up with this elegant design for the numbers. He created the idea. And he got the numbers every day from the local newspaper, from a New York newspaper, because he saw that something called the clearinghouse, which I believe was a precursor to what we think of as stock market figures that appear in the paper, basically he saw that those numbers were different all the time. And he just got the idea, I'll take the last 3 digits and make that the winning number for each day. Well, fast forward, and every city that adopted the numbers created their own formula for how they would actually pick winners. Most of them chose to pick winners from the daily racing forms at various racetracks based on the winning horses for each of the various races. And I love to tell people that I learned that system long enough to write that paragraph in my book, and then I forgot it because it is complicated. It has something to do with, you know, taking the numbers that are to the left of the decimal point once you figure out the calculations based on all these various races. It was something. I love telling people, though, that while my aunt Florence, my mom's youngest and remaining sister, would say to me, "Yeah, I never could figure out how they came up with those numbers. But Fanny, she could do it. She could do the calculations. She could take a daily racing form and do the very convoluted calculation and be able to determine what the number was.
So if it was so hard to figure out what the winning number was, how was the winning number circulated? How did people know that their number had hit?
The big numbers bosses employed people who helped with those calculations. Once the numbers bosses signed off on the daily winners, then the word went out, almost like a game of telephone, except they had to get it right. You know, various people called various folks that were part of that larger hierarchy and shared the news, and then it would trickle down.
That requires a level of trust.
It absolutely does. It absolutely does.
Describe the point of view you had as a child when you were, say, like 7 or 8, watching your mother collect all this money, do all the math, keep track of what the winning number was, count her cash. Because you say you have this indelible image burned in your mind of your mother sitting there counting cash.
Yes.
So what did this all look like to you as a child?
It was my normal. I really had no other reference. I knew that other mothers weren't like my mom, but it was simply her job. It was what she did.
It was also anxiety-provoking, though, wasn't it? Because you must have known even at a young age that there was a lot of risk involved with this.
Yes. There was always one point in the day when it was stressful. And that's when the number was about to be announced. The anticipation of what each day's number was going to be brought a lot of anxiety. Because once we all knew that number, things could go either way. It could be a good day, which meant my mom didn't get hit. No one played a winning number with her that day, or not for a lot of money. But the opposite could be true too, that one or more of her customers could have actually won, hit the number, and she was responsible for paying them the next day by noon, which was her policy. So yes, that could be really stress-inducing, and yet what I believe, now that I think about it, is that it wasn't overwhelmingly stressful, because I had never seen my mother not figure it out.
I know the phone must have been ringing all the time at your home, but what about house calls? Did people come to put money on their number?
Yes. Some people, some of her older, reliable customers whom she'd been working with for many years, they preferred to come by the house because it was sort of a social interaction. It was communal. They liked Fanny. They wanted to be in her presence. And maybe they were old school and they just wanted to put the money in her hands. They wanted to sit down and think about what numbers to play while they were at the house, sitting at the kitchen table, talking about it. What looks good? What do you think? Also, I think that for a lot of Black folks, it was a little magical. It was such a incredibly sort of pleasurable ritual, and it gave people a way to try to give meaning to their lives for different reasons. It feels good, for instance, to say, you know, I was thinking about my father. I miss him so much. I decided to look up what his name plays for because he's really been on my mind. And so I went to the dream book and I found that his name plays for 641. I'm going to play that today. And you feel some kind of way about it. You feel as though you've done this thing that helps you think about this person you love, that, you know, gives you a chance to win something. And if you do win, maybe your father helped you win. But many of my mom's customers called in their numbers over the phone.
So how would your mother collect the money from them?
There was always, Saturdays was collecting day. Because my mom let them play on credit. She let them play all week. And then at the end of the week, she collected her money from them. My stepfather or some young man that she hired, that she trusted, would often drive around to house to collect the money.
Running the numbers was a risky business, too. What were the risks that your family took because your mother ran the numbers?
The biggest risk of all was actually getting caught, actually having authorities bust your business. So that was always looming, but it wasn't made apparent. By that I mean we just knew to keep it a secret, all of us. We understood we couldn't tell anyone because if you did, it might make its way back to authorities. But we didn't have those discussions. It wasn't like, oh, I hope we don't get busted today. My mom never said that. She just was thorough. She was very discreet, and she was consistent. Those were her qualities that mitigated, you know, the possibilities of getting caught. That was the biggest risk. The other risk was that she would get hit so big that she'd owe so much money that it would wipe her out financially. So those were the two big risks. And it's amazing to me now to think about the fact that she lived under the specter of both of them for 34 years. She ran her business for 34 years.
There's another risk you didn't mention, and that's of being robbed.
Oh, yeah, there was that also. Absolutely. I mean, it's a cash business. And so she had lots of safeguards, you know, against being robbed. She kept her money in a safe in the house inside of her bedroom closet. It was a combination safe. She also had two pistols. One she carried in her purse, and the other she kept in the linen closet underneath her linens. And that was necessary, in part because, yes, she was involved in a cash business, and also, to be honest, we were living in Detroit at a time when it was really dangerous in many ways. So she wanted to keep us safe. She wanted to keep herself safe, and it was not an unusual precaution.
You describe a whole infrastructure of black businesses created from the profits of running the numbers. So can you tell us about that?
Back when the numbers were really thriving in Detroit in the 30s, 40s, 50s, even before my mom got involved, we forget how segregated this country was. And even in the North, black folks couldn't just walk into a downtown hotel, for instance, and stay there. They couldn't do that. They weren't allowed. And so numbers men were also race men, and they believed in taking their largesse and in reinvesting it in the community, starting all kinds of businesses, everything from, say, a bowling alley to an insurance company to a newspaper. I mean, these were services that were fulfilling needs that the state, that the government was not for black folks. So it was really quite important. Two of my favorite examples. One, few people know that the NAACP was fledgling back in the day in Detroit and was infused with cash by numbers men who really propped it up and gave it life again. Now, this is important because soon enough, when the civil rights movement was at its height, the Detroit chapter of the NAACP was one of its biggest chapters, and they were vital in helping the movement. And they had been buttressed by numbers men. I love hearing that because it really very beautifully connects the role of this underground economy and black American culture and life and progress. Another example is that a man named Roxborough brought the numbers to Detroit. He's the one who literally started them in the city. And he actually went on to be Joe Louis's manager. He invested in Joe Louis. He invested financially in him. He groomed him. He helped him to become the heavyweight champion of the world. We would not have Joe Louis, I don't think, if we had not had the numbers man who basically helped create Joe Louis the boxer.
So there was a lot of pressure on you as a child to keep your mother's business a secret because it was illegal. So in school one day, in first grade, your teacher asks you, what do your parents do for a living? And, like, you know, you couldn't say what your father did because, actually you did, you said he doesn't work because he can't work, he has health problems, he was injured at work. And she said, so what does your mother do? And, of course, you could not answer that. You said something like, oh, well, I don't know, because your mother was in the illegal economy. You couldn't really give a straight answer to that to your teacher. Right. And then she started asking you, looking at your shoes, she said, how many pair of shoes do you have? Tell us the story.
Exactly. So just a week after she had already asked me what my mom did for a living, and I lied and said, I don't know. She then said to me, you sure do have a lot of pairs of shoes. And I nodded. And she said, you know what? Before you sit down, I want you to name every pair of shoes you have. And I was so nervous. And I thought, well, this is a test. I have to get it right. I tried to envision every pair of shoes in my closet that were on this shelf. And I managed to come up with 10 pairs of shoes, each one, the color, the style. And she looked at me, I mean, it was not a good look. She looked at me and said, 10 pairs is an awful lot. Well, I just nodded. I didn't know what else to do. And she let me sit down. And I thought that was it. But then the next day, I wore a pair of shoes that I had not told her about. I wore a white pair of patent leather shoes. And she pointed it out to me. She said, you did not tell me that you had white shoes, too. I apologized. I said I was sorry. And she was so dismissive, she just said, sit down. And at that point, I thought, I've got to tell my mom about this because I actually was concerned that I had done something wrong and that I was going to get in trouble. And I thought, well, I better tell her. I told my mom what happened, and she immediately got so furious that I thought she was angry at me. And then she said to me, that is none of her damn business. Who does she think she is? And then, before I could even be relieved that she wasn't angry at me, she said, get in the car. So I did. And I thought, oh my God, are we driving back to the school to confront Miss Miller? Terrified. But we weren't. My mom ended up taking me to Saks Fifth Avenue. And I had never been there before. So we walked into the store. It was beautiful. She took me to the shoe department, the children's shoe department, where there were all these beautiful shoes. She pointed to a yellow pair, a gorgeous pair of yellow patent leather shoes, and she said, those are nice, those are pretty. She literally pulled out a $100 bill and paid for those shoes in cash. And then she said to me, you are going to wear these shoes to school tomorrow, you hear me? And you better tell that teacher of yours, you better tell that damn teacher of yours, that you actually have a dozen pairs of shoes, you hear me? I did what I was told. I wore them the next day. I very timidly walked up to Miss Miller and said, I actually have a dozen pairs of shoes. She looked at me with such disdain. Oh, and then she never, ever said another word to me.
Was there a racial subtext there?
Very much so. When I was 6 years old, all I remember is her blonde bouffant and those blue eyes. But later, because it stuck with me so long, I understood what was so upsetting. I knew she was judging me. I knew she was thinking, you little black girl, you don't deserve that. How dare you? I don't have 10, 12 pairs of shoes. I mean, I came to understand that's what felt so, you know, it was a little humiliating to have to defend what I had that way. And I must say, even though she didn't speak to me anymore, you know, I was a little bothered by that, but mostly I was relieved, just relieved that I didn't have to be put to the test anymore.
What was left of your mother's business when she died of cancer, and what year was that?
My mother died of cancer in 1992, and at the point she died, my sister Rita had taken over the business and had taken in her customers and had begun to run the business, which she was quite capable of doing because she had always helped my mother out over the years. And my sister managed to keep running the business, I would say, for not quite a couple more years. And then she decided, you know, it's time to just let it go.
Was the business doing well at the end, or was it a struggle?
I think at the end, it was a much smaller business.
Mm-hmm.
And what it did do was provide for my nephew, my mother's grandson, to complete college. That was a promise that we had made to her. We knew it was very important to her that he finished school because she died when he was 20. He was in college when she died. And so those proceeds that my sister collected from the smaller version of the business were a very important infusion because that money enabled him to finish college.
Your mother had five children and lost three of them in the 1980s. Your 33-year-old brother was shooting pool at a neighborhood bar. He got into an argument. He saw the guy had a gun, and when your brother ran out, he was shot in the back and killed. Your 37-year-old sister, Diane, was shot and killed by her husband in a murder-suicide after she told him she wanted a divorce. And your 35-year-old sister had a heart attack and died. That's a lot of tragedy to survive in one decade. How did you handle that?
I don't know. That's the completely honest answer. I do not know. I just remember feeling as though I could not add more of a burden to my mother, that the last thing I wanted to do was give her something more to worry about by having to worry about me. And so I know that that enabled me to soldier through.
Well, I want to thank you for writing the book. It's a great book, and I want to thank you for our conversation. I really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Bridgette Davis is the author of the new memoir, The World According to Fannie Davis, My Mother's Life in the Detroit Numbers.
Say, Winona, I was by your house last night, and guess what happened?
What happened, Mom?
Your grandma was playing the numbers.
Well, you just finding that out?
Well, what do you know?
We found out.
Yes, we did.
We found out.
Now we know.
We found out.
We found out that grandma plays the numbers.
We found out.
Yes, we did.
We found out.
She couldn't keep it hid.
We found out.
Now we know that grandma plays the numbers. Thinks about them every day. Dreams about them every night. Gets up early in the morning. See that the numbers comes out just right.
We found out.
Yes, we know.
We found out.
Bless her soul.
We found out.
Now we know that grandma plays the numbers.
The new movie, Everybody Knows, stars Penelope Cruz and Javier Bardem. It's made by the Iranian filmmaker Oscar Farhadi, who won Oscars for his films A Separation and The Salesman. Our critic at large, John Power, says it's good, but it has limitations compared to another foreign film currently up for an Oscar.
When people talk about art, they often argue over whether individual works can be truly universal. One who thinks they can is Asghar Farhadi, the gifted Iranian filmmaker who in recent years has won foreign film Oscars for both A Separation and The Salesman. As he puts it, the taste of love and the taste of hate are everywhere the same. That belief in universality gets put to the test in his latest film, Everybody Knows, a tale of love and crime that finds him working for the first time in Spain with a cast of Spanish-speaking stars. Farhadi has a real knack for domestic dramas that unfold with the suspense of psychological thrillers. And that's just what you get here. Penelope Cruz stars as Laura, a Spaniard who lives in Buenos Aires with her architect husband Alejandro, played by the famous Argentine actor Ricardo Darín. As the action begins, Laura and her two kids are returning to the Spanish village where she grew up to attend the wedding of her sister. There she meets her now-married old flame Paco, played by Javier Bardem with more than a smidgen of ham. Paco's a bull of a man who owns the winemaking estate that once belonged to Laura's family. And we wonder, do the two still feel the same old spark? Everything seems cool until the drunken wedding party, when Laura's teenage daughter gets kidnapped, a ransom is demanded, and Alejandro, who who everybody knows is rich, has to jet north from Argentina. The abduction tears away all the good feelings, exposing years of male rivalry, sibling squabbles, financial resentments, and clandestine yearnings. Laura, Paco, Alejandro, and the others must grapple with moral issues and the weight of the past. Everybody knows something, even if what they know isn't true. When the picture premiered at Cannes last May, it was compared unfavorably to competition hits like Shoplifters and Cold War. But context is all. If you put Everybody Knows next to the movies coming out on a normal week like this one, you'll be delighted by its old-fashioned Hollywood virtues, a seductive setting, a lively if messy story, and a cast of sexy, talented actors who are fun to watch, even if Cruise has to cry a bit too much. As ever, Farhadi shines at creating characters whose emotional complexity helps disguise his penchant for arbitrary plot twists. If that disguise proves less effective here, it's largely because Farhadi is working in a country and a language that isn't his own. Although the movie doesn't feel touristic, he spent 2 years living in Spain before shooting. It does feel thin next to a separation, which is rooted in a home country whose daily lives and social issues Farhadi knows in his bones. Every scene of that film brims with interesting textures and details of Iranian life. This isn't true of Everybody Knows, which feels less universal than generic. Its limitations become clearer if you put it alongside Cold War, a Best Foreign Film nominee whose Polish-born auteur, Paweł Pawlikowski, made the Oscar-winning Ida. Pawlikowski tells a story based on his parents' tortuous relationship. We follow the roller coaster ride of the romance between Victor, a detached-seeming jazz composer, and a passionate woman singer named Zula. Their love carries them from late 40s Poland, where communism was taking a firm grip, to 50s Paris, and then back into Eastern Europe's bleak 1960s. Cold War is an immaculately crafted film, shot in exquisite black and white and marvelously acted, especially by its incandescent lead actress Joanna Kulik, whose mercurial performance recalls Jean Moreau. At 84 minutes, this is the rare movie that could be longer. Indeed, if Farhadi's film is a slab of brie oozing ripe emotion, Pawlikowski's is as condensed and richly flavored as a perfectly sliced sliver of finely aged Parmesan. Cold War's richness comes from being steeped in detail. This is both personal, the lovers are even named after Pawlikowski's parents, and cultural, from the wailing Polish folk music that begins the film, to the party bureaucrats who transform art into red propaganda, to the smoky Parisian nightclubs where Victor finds liberation and Zula sinks into uprooted alienation. From beginning to end, Cold War demonstrates what Everybody Knows does not. The road to the universal actually begins with the specific.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large. Coming up, we talk with Random House copy chief Benjamin Dreyer, author of the new book with the sarcastically self-important title Dreyer's English, an utterly correct guide to clarity and style. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Benjamin Dreyer, was recently described in the Washington Post as the unofficial language guru on Twitter. Dreyer's work home is the book publisher Random House, where he's a vice president, executive managing editor, and copy chief. He gets the final say over questions related to grammar, style, and clarity at that publishing house. He's been the copy editor for books by such authors as Michael Chabon, E.L. Doctorow, Janet Ivanovich, Michael Pollan, Frank Rich, Isabella Rossellini, Richard Russo, and Calvin Trillin. Now he's sharing his advice in his new, humbly titled book, Dreyer's English, An Utterly Correct Guide to Clarity and Style. Benjamin Dreyer, welcome to Fresh Air. First, let's start with the subtitle of your book, An Utterly Correct Guide to Clarity and Style. Let's establish that you're trying, you're succeeding in being funny with that. You don't mean it as being truly, utterly correct. Because style is in some ways pretty subjective, isn't it?
Yes, and I do mean to be funny, and I like to think that there's a bit of a wink contained in the subtitle. that it's a little bit of a joke, and let's just start off with the notion that we're all in on it. Style is indeed extremely subjective. I think that if there's one point I am trying to make in the book, that any notions of what constitutes correctness or any notion of what constitutes right versus wrong, whatever those things might possibly be, those are all subsumed to the notion of A, clarity, and B, just the joy of writing. And everything is about the clarity and everything is about the joy. So you have to make all those notions of what's correct work for you or not work for you, as the case may be.
So I heard you say that when you started writing this book, the writing was putting you to sleep, and you finally realized you should write in your Twitter voice, which was funny and concise and personal and chatty. I was expecting you to criticize Twitter for avoiding the rules of grammar, but that's where you found your voice.
It is where I found my voice. And when you have to contend with only having 140 characters to move around in, and then eventually, of course, to have 280 characters to move around in, you have to make your point. You have to make it succinctly. And if you're me and you're trying to engage people, you have to sort of also try to be funny. You have to make people want to read your tweet as opposed to going and reading somebody else's tweet.
So some advice you gave on Twitter this week, which you also give in the opening of your book, is avoid this list of words for a week. Very, rather, really, as in that was really terrific. Quite, in fact, just, so don't start a sentence with so. Pretty.
Actually, I don't yeah. necessarily mean that so, though
we
can do with that. It's so big, so smart,
okay.
So this, so
okay.
that.
Okay. Avoid pretty as in that was pretty tedious, surely.
Yes.
And that said, I think maybe I shouldn't use those words. So you describe these as WAN, W-A-N, WAN intensifiers and throat clearers. So I'm pretty sure you've been listening to me on Fresh Air making notes of the weed words that I overuse, because that's my partial list of words that I use too much. but I guess I'm not alone. So maybe it's not just me you've been listening to. So tell us your objections to these words.
First, I want to emphasize that my job is, if I'm going to be running around policing things, I'm there to police written prose. I'm happily not there to govern how people speak, and that includes me. And if you and I both become self-conscious at the extent to which either one of us is using the word very right now, we're going to grind to a complete halt. Because I'm already sort of, I can hear myself and I'm kind of counting them. And so I'm just going to sort of let that go so that we can have a conversation. I do think that on paper, they're essentially a waste of space, and certainly the that saids and the well actuallys are serving no purpose, so get rid of them. As to the WAN intensifiers, as I also do say, feel free to write them, just go back and get rid of them after you've written them. And one thing I'll add, and I don't mean to pick so much on the word very, but I believe that people use it, I mean, indeed, they use it as an intensifier. They use it to strengthen and emphasize how they feel about something, and it ends up coming off on the page somewhat defensively. I think that if you say that somebody is brilliant, that's a sort of a bold, definitive statement. If you say that somebody is very brilliant, it's like, I really mean it. So let it sit by itself and do its job and be a little bold about it.
But if you say somebody's very smart, it might mean that they're shy of brilliant. But they're smarter than just your average smart. So you stick in the very there to show like the gradation. It's like a B+. It's not a B or an
Sure.
A.
Sure. Or we might find some other adjective on the spectrum of adjectives that might cover that middle ground a little better. But again, I don't want to be, I don't want to be a bully about it. I don't want to be a martinet about it. And I'm sure there are a number of varies in the book, though I did make quite certain that after I discuss the word actually, that any actuallys that were sitting in the rest of the book are they're gone.
So did you just like hit find on your Word document and get rid of them?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It feels like cheating sometimes to be able to search a document for things rather than to move through it painstakingly word by word, but you make use of the technology as it offers itself up to you.
You're right. I sometimes feel as if I spend half my life prying up commas and the other half tacking them down someplace else. And you're referring here to when you edit somebody's book. So let's talk a little bit about commas. And let's start with probably the most controversial comma of all, the serial comma, or as it's also known, the Oxford comma. Explain what that is.
The serial comma, or the Oxford comma, or as I've sort of settled on calling it, the series comma, is that comma that exists toward the end of a list before the final item, that final item as a rule being preceded by the word and or the word or, as for instance, apples, comma, bananas, comma, and cherries. So that last comma, that second comma, that's the series comma.
The one right before the end, cherries.
The one right before the end.
Mm-hmm.
Almost everybody in book publishing, I'd say, favors the series comma. Many people who work in journalism were trained not to use it, so they don't use it, and they give heavy side eye to people who do use it. And of course, we all like the things that we like, and we all like the things that we're used to. I find the series comma highly useful because, among other things, it separates those two last items on the list. It keeps them from looking as if they have some sort of special relationship, that they're sort of a pair, and you don't mean them to be a pair. They are simply the last two items on a list.
Can I give an example? I had a meal of Brussels sprouts, French fries, ham, and eggs. You don't know if you had ham and eggs, you know, like as one dish, or whether there was ham and then also eggs. So is it ham and eggs, or is it ham, comma, and eggs?
Exactly. And if we were speaking of ham and eggs in a list, I think I might, as copy editor, suggest picking up ham and eggs and moving it into the middle of the list so that those two items could sit next to each other unpunctuated, they would appear as a unit, and there would be no confusion.
Well, they'd still have a comma in between, right? If there was more two things, yeah.
If I said we sat down to breakfast and we had French toast, comma, ham and eggs, comma.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Oatmeal.
Right. Right.
And then you have a very clear list, and you know what belongs to what and what doesn't belong to what.
Okay, you have a great sentence in here that I'm going to read, also displaying why the serial comma or the series comma might be very helpful. So this is the Nelson Mandela sentence?
The famous Nelson Mandela sentence.
It's a famous sentence?
Everybody drags it out in conversations about the use of the series comma. I can't remember the first time I encountered it, and I was trying very hard not to use it in my book because I'd seen it so frequently, but I thought, let's just drag it out one more time.
Okay, I'm dragging it.
Okay, let's drag.
Here it comes. Highlights of his global tour include encounters with Nelson Mandela, comma, an 800-year-old demigod, and a dildo collector. Okay, so the only comma we have there is after Nelson Mandela. Okay, what's confusing about that sentence?
Well, the way the sentence is constructed with just that one comma, it suggests that you are identifying beyond the comma after Nelson Mandela that he is the next two things you are mentioning. So Nelson Mandela is indeed a demigod and a dildo collector.
Okay, so if you change it to highlights of his global tour include encounters with Nelson Mandela, comma, an 800-year-old demigod, comma, and a dildo collector. How's that?
It's almost better, and it's one of the reasons I will say this sentence is not a good defense of the series comma, because adding the series comma does not entirely clarify it. Some sentences can't simply be repunctuated. They need to be reordered or reconstructed so that they can make better sense. And I think that if you, for instance, change that to highlights of his tour included encounters with an 800-year-old demigod, comma, a dildo collector, comma, and Nelson Mandela, at long last, I think we can be pretty certain we all understand that we are speaking about three different things.
Okay. Is there
This is what I do all day.
You edit fiction and nonfiction. So in fiction, there's usually a lot of dialogue. And people get tired of saying he said, she said, so they try to elaborate on that. And examples you use are, she cried ecstatically. He remarked decisively. He asked helplessly. You don't really like those adverbs.
I don't mind them. I mean, I like adverbs very much. I know that many people think that adverbs are dreadful, and I use them all the time. In fact, there's that great big honking utterly in the subtitle of my book. I think that authors frequently are reaching for alternatives to he said and she said because they fear that the reader is going to become bored with the he saids and the she saids. And I view those sorts of things as kind of invisible skeleton. Readers don't particularly notice them. They're there to support the dialogue. They're there to support what it is that you're doing. So just let them do that. There's nothing wrong with the occasional he cried ecstatically. But you don't want to keep doing that over and over and over again. You know, it's like I don't really maybe have anything nice to say about she remonstrated decisively.
So you describe yourself as pretty conservative when it comes to language. So I'm wondering if you're keeping up with changes in gender that are being originated by people who don't identify as male or female and who want to be called they, or are coming up with other ways to describe themselves that aren't he or she. And I'm wondering, as this new sense of identity enters the world and a new language to correspond to it, what you as a copy editor are making of that.
This ultimately was the intersection of my perspective as a copy editor and my perspective as a human being. I remember reading a few years ago an article in the New York Times that was all about a person who did not identify as male or female. And I made my way through the article, which was extremely well written. And toward the end of the article, there was a quotation. There was a description of this person by this person's father or mother that referred to the person as they, and then was added parenthetically, using a pronoun that the Times does not use. And I then went back and I read the entire article and realized that the writer of the article had managed to write the entire article about this person without ever resorting to a pronoun. And it was done seamlessly and eloquently. And I was on the one hand, I was sort of impressed by the effort, while at the same time, I was also beginning to contemplate the necessity of this avoidance. And then what happened subsequently is that I gained a colleague whose pronoun of choice is they. And when I was first introduced to this colleague, I found myself for months doing anything I could in writing or even in speech to avoid applying a pronoun. I'd refer to the colleague as the colleague. I mean, can you hear how dreadfully stilted I'm becoming?
Yes.
And I would refer to the colleague by name. And at one point, even I began to realize how ridiculous I was. And the word they popped out of my mouth. And I thought, oh, be done with it already. You know, like, just honor your colleague. Honor this person that you work with. Honor this person you actually like a lot. And honor the pronoun choice. And it shouldn't have to take... It shouldn't have to take something personal, you know, a one-on-one encounter with another human being. It shouldn't necessarily have to take that sort of thing to make you to make you evolve properly. You should, you know, maybe you should be a better person and you should be able to do it in the abstract. But sometimes it does take a personal encounter to get you to change how you see things.
Well, I think, like, if you're genderqueer, if there's a lot of, like, rights that you're going to have trouble getting because of discrimination in our society. One of the things you should not be deprived of is like the right to have a pronoun.
Right.
Like that shouldn't be something that you have to go to the Supreme Court for, to have a pronoun to use to describe yourself.
Yeah, and the last thing that I want to do is to pass myself off as some sort of ferocious gatekeeper who, in some sort of argument about the purity and the wonder of the English language and how it must be preserved, is simply being unkind and cruel to other human beings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I've learned anything in my increasing years, it's that just being kind, you know, being respectful is more important than how I feel about pronouns.
Benjamin Dreyer, thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Benjamin Dreyer is the copy chief at Random House and author of the new book, Dreyer's English, An Utterly Correct Guide to Clarity and Style. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Muj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.